Welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast for December 23rd, 2014. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and today I'm talking with Chris Wood about signaling pathways that enable cancer cells to develop drug resistance. There are many different types of mutations that can allow cells to become cancerous and grow out of control. Many of these mutations affect signaling pathways that control cell proliferation or cell survival. Although we can identify some of the mutations that drive cancer cell growth and then develop drugs that block or counteract the effects of these mutations, stopping cancer is not as simple as targeting one mutant protein or even one pathway with drugs. When you block one signaling pathway that drives cancer cell growth, the cells may acquire additional mutations or rewire their signaling networks to get around that block. Even a drug that initially slows the growth of tumors or kills the cancer cells can become ineffective if the cells develop resistance. In two new studies published in this week's issue of Science Signaling, my guest Chris Wood explores the mechanisms by which signaling pathways can cooperate to promote anti-cancer drug resistance. Wood spoke to me from Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Dr. Wood, welcome to the Science Signaling Podcast.
Thank you.
In the first of this pair of papers, the paper by Winter et al., your group looked at why myeloproliferative neoplasms, which are overgrowths of bone marrow cells that can progress to leukemia, often are resistant to inhibitors of the kinase JAK, despite having mutations that activate JAK2. Why don't JAK inhibitors kill those cells?
Through our studies, what we found was that the activation of the oncogene RAS and its downstream effector pathways, namely the PI3 kinase AKT pathway and the MEK-ERK pathway, can rescue survival in the context of JAK2 inhibition in these cells. What we found is that by looking downstream of JAK-STAT signaling, ultimately what happens in these cells is that activated JAK-STAT signaling leads to the phosphorylation and thereby the inactivation of a pro-apoptotic protein called BAD. When JAK is inhibited, that phosphorylation is lost and the cells ordinarily die. However, when RAS and its effector pathways are activated, BAD phosphorylation is rescued, and with it, cell viability is also rescued by shutting down the process of apoptosis initiated by JAK inhibition.
There are existing drugs that target RAS signaling pathways. Can you combine these drugs with JAK inhibitors to kill the cells?
So yes, you can. We showed in our studies that while RAS has a number of effector pathways, the key effector pathways with respect to drug resistance in this context are the PI3K and the MEK-ERK pathways. And in fact, there are a multitude of drugs that are in various stages of preclinical and clinical development that inhibit these two pathways. What we showed in our studies is that if you examine cells that are resistant to JAK inhibition and you co-treat those cells with inhibitors, particularly inhibitors of the PI3 kinase AKT pathway, that you can dramatically resensitize these cells to JAK inhibition, and you can further sensitize them if you also inhibit the MEK-ERK pathway.
That combination of drugs can be used to kill these cells that have both activated JAK and activated RAS signaling. Do you know what percentage of real-world myeloproliferative neoplasms have both activated JAK signaling and activated RAS signaling, and thus might be susceptible to that combination of drugs?
We don't know for sure, but we can estimate a lower bound on that number. And the way that we did that was by looking simply in patient samples for coincident activating mutations in JAK2 and activating mutations in either KRAS or NRAS. And what we found in a panel of about 40 patient samples was that about 14% of those samples have coincident activating mutations in both JAK2 and in KRAS or NRAS. So that strongly suggests that in that minority of patients, it's highly likely that these RAS effector pathways are activated. However, the clinical data tells us that a larger fraction of patients actually exhibit intrinsic resistance to this drug. And what we speculate, although we don't have data to support this, is that, of course, the activation of RAS or its effector pathways can happen by really a multitude of means. It can happen by activating mutations in members of the PI3K-AKT pathway or members of the MEK-ERK pathway that don't include RAS. And it can also occur via activation by soluble growth factors that activate RAS signaling, for example, through receptor tyrosine kinases. So our suspicion is that while activating mutations in RAS may co-occur with JAK mutations in a minority of patients, that other patients may actually achieve the same endpoint by activating these pathways through alternative means.
Are there other types of cancers that are characterized by activation of these two pathways of both JAK and RAS signaling? So are they potentially candidates for being targetable by this combination of drugs?
There are. In fairness, I think that these myeloproliferative neoplasms are a bit unique in the sense that activating mutations in a JAK protein family member are considered to be one of the key initiating events and driver events in the oncogenic process. They are unique in that respect amongst most other human cancers. However, there are cancers that are driven by activating mutations in RAS. And a great example of that would be pancreatic cancers, where about 95% of tumors have activating mutations in KRAS. And there's a lot of emerging evidence that suggests that the JAK-STAT pathway is coincidentally activated in these patients. And there's actually early clinical data suggesting that inhibitors of the JAK-STAT pathway may have some efficacy in this disease. So this is certainly a context that, while different from the setting of myeloproliferative neoplasms, may be an interesting candidate for further examination.
So now I want to move on to the second in this pair of papers, the paper by Martz and colleagues. This paper describes a screen for identifying signaling pathways that have the potential to confer anti-cancer drug resistance. What was the rationale behind that screen, and how did you perform the screen?
A lot of studies have been done in the last few years that seek to identify mechanisms of resistance to anti-cancer drugs, particularly targeted therapies. And while all of these studies, many of which have been excellent, have revealed individual genetic events which, when they occur, are capable of driving resistance, what they have sometimes not shed so much light on are the pathways through which these events act. And so one of the questions that we and a lot of others in the field had was, rather than trying to understand the discrete genetic events that could lead to resistance to a drug, of which there are many, would it be possible to actually identify the key effector pathways through which cancer cells can achieve a resistant state? And would it be possible to do that in a way that was relatively rapid and scalable? And so the idea that we had was that we could go into cancer cells and we could systematically turn on individual oncogenic pathways, the pathways that control growth and survival in cancer cells, and that consequently are often responsible for drug resistance, and then identify which of those pathways, when constitutively activated, is sufficient to drive resistance to a given drug. And so the way that we did this was we created a library of lentiviral cDNA constructs that encode constitutive activators of individual oncogenic signaling pathways. And then we conceived of an experimental approach by which we could screen them rapidly. And the way that the approach works is that we take all the members of the library, we mix them together, and we infect cells with that pool of mixed lentiviruses, each encoding a distinct pathway activator. We infect cells at a low multiplicity of infection, and that allows us to ensure that we are only introducing a single pathway activator into each cell. And then we take that cell population and we treat it with drugs, and we essentially look for the pathway activators that become enriched in the cell population over the course of a drug treatment. The idea being that those constitutive pathway activators that are enriched over time in the presence of drug treatment could potentially drive resistance to that drug. So in our particular study, given that we were sort of powered to investigate the landscape of pathways that are capable of driving resistance to drugs in a manner that's relatively scalable, we decided to try to look at this problem from a relatively global perspective. And so we assembled a collection of cancer cell lines, and we treated those cell lines with appropriate drugs, representing drugs that inhibit key oncogenic events in those cells. Many of these drugs are clinically approved, and in other cases, they are in preclinical or late-stage clinical trials. And the cancers represented in our screen collection included solid tumors like melanomas and breast cancers, as well as lung cancers, gastric cancers, and a small number of liquid tumors like lymphomas.
The first set of experiments focused on pathways that confer resistance to a MAP kinase pathway inhibitor. Now, these inhibitors have been used for quite a while clinically, so there's already quite a bit of information on how cancer cells develop resistance to these drugs. Did you identify any pathways that were previously unrecognized as playing a role in resistance to MAP kinase pathway inhibitors?
Sure. Well, you're right that these drugs are important clinically and that they've been the subject of a lot of really wonderful studies by a number of people in the community who have tried to understand the mechanisms of resistance to these drugs, because resistance is a really important clinical problem in this setting. We actually chose to do our first screens in the setting of MAP kinase inhibitor sensitive BRAF mutant melanoma cells precisely because they had been studied extensively, based on the reasoning that whatever we found from a screen, we could check against what was already known. We did that, and we found that we were able to uncover the principal drivers that had been the subjects of most of the papers that had been previously published in this area, those being the PI3 kinase pathway, the MAP kinase pathway, and to a lesser extent, the NF-kappa-B pathway. We also found additional pathways that, when activated, are capable of driving resistance to these drugs, at least in an in vitro setting. And one of those pathways was the Notch1 pathway. Notch1 has been described as a regulator of a number of important cellular and oncogenic processes, and it's also been implicated in resistance to, for example, cytotoxic chemotherapies. But it's not ever been implicated in the context of melanoma or resistance to a targeted therapy like a MAP kinase inhibitor. We ultimately found through a series of follow-up studies that the activation of the Notch1 pathway causes melanoma cells to undergo a dedifferentiation process that makes them broadly resistant to inhibitors of the MAP kinase pathway at multiple nodes. And what we found was that, interestingly, if you look in patients who have become resistant to MAP kinase inhibitors, you can actually separate those patient samples into those that are harboring well-known, previously described resistance mechanisms and those that aren't. And it is in that second group, the group of patients whose tumors are resistant but by unknown mechanisms, where we see lots of evidence of potential Notch1 pathway activation.
After you got the results from this initial set of experiments looking at resistance mechanisms with MAP kinase pathway inhibitors, you went on looking for signaling pathways that were involved in resistance to other anti-cancer drugs. What drugs did you choose and why?
A lot of our studies were in breast cancer, and breast cancer is an interesting disease for a number of reasons, and one of them is that it is a cancer that has been targeted with targeted chemotherapies quite a bit more often than a lot of other cancers. So drugs like HER2 or estrogen receptor inhibitors, as well as inhibitors targeting, for example, the activated PI3 kinase pathway, have been explored in breast cancer at various levels, ranging from the clinically approved estrogen modulators or estrogen inhibitors like tamoxifen and fulvestrant, as well as HER2 inhibitors like lapatinib and Herceptin, through more investigational drugs like those impinging directly on the PI3 kinase pathway. So in our studies, we took breast cancer cells sensitive to each of these drugs, and we performed screens to try to map the pathways of resistance. We found in these screens that two pathways, the RAS-MAP kinase pathway and the PI3 kinase AKT pathway, can generally provide resistance to a lot of these drugs. And that actually wasn't entirely surprising to us. A number of reports in the past have implicated these pathways in resistance to these drugs. But we also found that the Notch1 pathway, the same pathway that we had found in melanoma, seemed to be able to cause very significant resistance to really all of these drugs in breast cancer. And that was something that we didn't expect. Much like the case of melanoma, we found that when breast cancer cells become resistant to these drugs via Notch1 activation, it appears to be working through stimulating what looks like a dedifferentiation process, which allows these cells to somehow survive this drug treatment. The mechanistic details are still being worked out, but just like the case of the melanoma drugs, we found that in breast cancer, there's also evidence of clinical relevance in this finding. And specifically, we looked at the anti-estrogen or the selective estrogen receptor modulator tamoxifen, which is widely used in patients with ER-positive breast cancer. In those patients, we did a couple of experiments. The first thing that we did is we looked in patient tumors for evidence of Notch1 activation, and then we asked if Notch1 activation predicts or had predictive impact with respect to patient outcomes. What we found is that when patients weren't treated with tamoxifen, having Notch1 on really didn't do anything for their sensitivity or their long-term survival outcomes, I should say. However, when patients are treated with tamoxifen, they, in general, get a survival benefit from tamoxifen treatment. But that benefit is almost entirely reversed when the Notch1 pathway has been activated in their cancers. So the implication here would be that the beneficial effects of tamoxifen seem to be largely reversed in patients whose tumors have simultaneous activation of the Notch1 pathway, which is correlative evidence suggesting that Notch1 may be playing an important role in these tumors. To get a little bit deeper into this, we used a mouse model, a model that was developed by our colleague Donald McDonald in his lab. And the way that this model works is that estrogen-positive breast cancer cells were implanted into mice, and those mice were treated chronically for a long time with tamoxifen until the point where they developed resistance to that drug. Once the tumors developed resistance, we did a couple of things. First, we measured gene expression in these tumors, and we found evidence of significant upregulation of the Notch1 pathway, consistent with our hypothesis that Notch1 might be driving resistance to this drug. We then did the more conclusive experiment, which is that we took these drug-resistant breast cancer tumors, we grew them in mice, and we treated them with either tamoxifen, a Notch inhibitor, or the combination. And we found, in a result that was actually fairly striking to us, that the combined treatment was able to suppress growth of these resistant tumors back to the level of their sensitive counterparts.
Can these results be translated directly into clinical practice using existing drugs, or are they more useful as a basis for further studies to develop new drugs or new combinatorial therapies?
We think that actually in the first paper that we discussed, the Winner et al. Paper involving JAK2-activated myeloproliferative neoplasms, their results actually directly suggest combination therapies that should be attempted in the clinic. The first set of such combination therapies would be those impinging simultaneously on JAK2 and either the PI3K-AKT pathway or the MEKRK pathway. The second set would be drugs impinging downstream of BAD directly at the level of mitochondrial apoptosis. So I didn't describe this earlier, but our studies revealed to us that these cells, whether they are in a sensitive or a drug-resistant state, are always exquisitely dependent upon a particular pro-survival protein called BCL-XL, and that the pharmacological inhibition of this protein caused death in both sensitive cells and in drug-resistant cells. So we think that those are findings that are potentially directly clinically applicable, and we're actually working to explore that right now with our colleagues. In the second paper, we think that our results also have potential clinical relevance, and we're working hard to try to explore that. But we think that it's a little bit further off because we think it's still important to try to understand specifically the proper context in which the combination therapies that we've uncovered that will be most beneficial to patients.
Chris, thanks for speaking with me.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
That was Chris Wood discussing two papers published in the December 23rd issue of Science Signaling. Those papers are by Winter and colleagues and Martz and colleagues, and you can read them online at stke.sciencemag.org. This will be our last podcast for 2014, so please join us again in 2015 for more interviews with scientists doing groundbreaking research in cellular signaling. The Science Signaling Podcast is a production of Science Signaling and the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, serving society. If you have any comments or questions, you can write to us at sciencesignalingeditors@aaas.org. I'm Annalisa Van Hook, and on behalf of Science Signaling and AAAS, thanks for listening.